You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art, criticism, and fandom, trying to pay attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. Slurping the soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden says, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl, big old chunk of homemade bread, gluten-free if that's your style, and help us enrich the reading experience and have some fun too. This is our fifth foray into the world of the Arabian Nights. If you remember or recall, if you listened to our last episode, we are in the midst of the story of, please excuse all my mispronunciations here, but we're in the story of King Umar ibn al-Nu'man and his sons Shrakan and Dhow al-Makan, and the strange and remarkable things that happened to them. And King Umar is already dead, having been assassinated through poison by the evil witch Dhat al-Dawai, and his son Shrakan is also dead at her hand, beheaded in his own tent. So our three title characters are already down to one, Dhow al-Makan. We'll see how long he lasts today. Anyway, he's full of grief at the loss of his father and his half-brother, so he calls his vizier to his side to hear remarkable stories and tales of lovers in days gone by. So we have those stories for you today that the vizier tells, as well as the conclusion of our tale. Maybe the stunning conclusion even. Anyway, helping me as always is a poet, essayist, and most important, a human being, although possibly an angel. Ridwan has opened the gates of paradise and forgotten to close them again, and is this wonderfully handsome man has come out. It's Dr. Michael Farmer.
Good morning, Josh. Good afternoon. What time is it there for you?
Yeah, it's evening.
Evening.
It's
good evening.
24 in the evening. But morning for you. So morning yes. Voices for Michael and evening voices for me.
I remember
no
once.
What time of day you're listening.
I remember once David Grubb said that his goal was to have an episode of our show where I sounded as low-key as I do on this show back in the day. And I had to explain to him the reason I sound low-key is because we always recorded at 6 o'clock in the morning, my time. So I was barely awake.
Yeah. Yes, it's very nice of you to take the morning end. I would struggle to do it, so I appreciate you doing it, especially on summer vacation. I would not see this hour in summer vacation.
Are you capable of sleeping in? I feel like I feel like when I turned 30, I became incapable of sleeping past about 7:30.
No, this is not a challenge for me.
I envy you.
I am a night owl, though. I like to stay up very late.
I do, too. So during the summer, I stay up late and get up early and then sleep all afternoon, yeah. which is my preferred schedule, to be fair. I like that a lot. It feels kind of Middle Eastern.
Yeah, Middle Eastern or feline.
In the heat of the day, right? It's going to be 95 degrees here in Atlanta today.
In hot Atlanta.
Yeah, the summer's upon us. Anyway, it feels more appropriate then to read the Arabian Nights.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. This one's definitely, I feel like every week there's some portion of the tale where I'm just like, this culture is so different from mine. Like, I just really don't even understand what's happening here. So, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, and every week I say, oh, I feel like one of the ones we're talking about today is one of my favorites, and that's true this week too. I love Aziz and Aziza, which we'll get to very soon.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so as Josh mentioned at the outset, Don Don the Vizier is going to tell Dawa Malak the story that's going to make him feel better about losing his half-brother. The story is called Taj Al-Muluk Karan and Princess Dunya, and we're going to get that story started, and then we're going to... It goes pretty quickly into a frame story, or into a nested story. I guess the frame story is Taj Al-Muluk. So one day, King Suleiman hears about this beautiful princess in a foreign kingdom. I believe the kingdom is the Camphor Islands, which just makes me think they must smell like icy hot.
Hmm.
You know, and the princess herself is kind of icy hot. So maybe that's not a coincidence.
Maybe so.
So, oh, I'm sorry. Actually, the one King Suleiman hears about is not Princess Dunya, so she's not from the Camphor Islands, but eventually we'll get to the Camphor Islands. So anyway, Suleiman hears...
This story is a little confusing at the beginning, because like you said, it does very quickly go into the nest story. So, yeah, go ahead.
So anyway, King Suleiman, who's, I think, of the White Kingdom, and he hears about this beautiful princess of the Green Kingdom, and so he sends his vizier out to her to propose marriage, and her father goes along with it, and the two are married, and they have the son, Taj Al-Muluk. And he grows up to be, as young men do in the Arabian Nights, he grows up to be a handsome and cultured young man. And when he's 18 years old, he's out hunting. And he meets this young merchant named Aziz. And Aziz is selling all sorts of stuff. But one of the things he's selling is this piece of embroidery that's the most beautiful thing that Taj Al-Muluk has ever seen. And it turns out that it has been embroidered by this princess named Dunya, and Taj Al-Muluk immediately falls in love with her sight unseen because of how beautiful her embroidery work is, which is a great detail. Lots and lots of men fall in love with lots and lots of women immediately upon seeing them in these stories. This might be the only one where he falls in love with her because of like a piece of art she has made. So I think that's really lovely. But before we can find out what happens to Taj Al-Muluk and Princess Dunya, we have to hear the story of Aziz, who has this very very sad story that Taj Al-Muluk wants to hear about. Do you have anything to say about the first part of that frame story, or do you want to get straight into Aziz?
Yeah, we should get into Aziz, and then because you'll wrap up the frame story with, you know, at the end, we'll come back so
right.
to the white and the green kingdoms. So
one day Aziz, who's the son of a wealthy merchant, he sees this beautiful woman sitting in a window, and she makes to him a series of hand gestures that he can't understand. So he goes to his cousin Aziza to ask what they mean. Now, this is already a weird thing, and it already shows that Aziz is not a very nice person, because he's been betrothed to Aziza since childhood, and she is deeply in love with him. And in fact, we see his callowness because the reason he sees this woman in the window to begin with is that he is supposed to marry Aziza today, and he kind of skips out on the wedding to go wandering around the city, and that's where he sees this woman in the window. So already we see that Aziz is not... this is a very one-sided relationship, and yet he's also dependent on Aziza because he has to go back and ask her what these hand gestures mean. This is one of the more unappealing protagonists of a story in this volume. Anyway,
For sure.
Aziza understands the hand gestures. She understands that they're this set of coded courtship gestures. And she explains them to Aziz, and she tells him how to respond to them. And he keeps seeing this woman in the window, and each time now he's able to give the correct gestures in response. And all of that is with Aziza's help. Every single time he goes back and gets instructions from her and then goes back to the woman in the window and successfully flirts with her, I guess you would say. Well, he makes several embarrassing failed attempts to meet the woman. A lot of them involve him... supposedly, if you're really in love with someone, you won't sleep. And I didn't sleep very well last night, Josh, so I wonder who I'm in love with. but and he can't help himself from eating too much and getting drunk, and so he falls asleep. But he finally does succeed, and he becomes the lover of the woman in the window. And this makes him overjoyed. He spends all his time with her. But meanwhile, his poor cousin is wasting away out of lovesickness and grief, and eventually she dies of a broken heart. But Aziz keeps visiting the beautiful woman. And one day he recites to her a poem that Aziza had written before she died. And as soon as the woman hears it, she immediately realizes he didn't write this poem. In fact, it was written by a woman, and the woman who wrote it was hopelessly in love with him. So it turns out that this beautiful woman in the window, this woman he's been having the affair with, she's called the daughter of Delilah the Wicked. And she's actually a kind of black widow who seduces men and then sleeps with them and then kills them. And she's actually going to do that to Aziz, but he recites this line that Aziza had insisted he remember. He had no idea why she insisted on this, because she didn't give him all this context, presumably because she doesn't want to disillusion him about the woman. But she tells him, you need to say loyalty is good, treachery is bad. And these are the magic words that keep the daughter of Delilah the Wicked from killing Aziz. Well, one day he's on his way to visit the daughter of Delilah, but he's drunk and he gets lost and he gets kidnapped by an old woman who, in order to protect him from Delilah, the daughter of Delilah, forces him to marry her daughter. And he's trapped in her house for a full year. This is one of the funnier passages. Let me find it here. One of the funnier passages in this section. The daughter... his new wife is talking to him, or his soon-to-be new wife is talking to him, and she says, all I want you to do with me is what the cock does. What is it that the cock does, I ask. She clapped her hands and laughed so much that she fell over backwards. Then she sat up, smiled, and said, light of my eyes, do you really not know what the cock does? No, by God, I don't, I replied. His business is eating, drinking, and copulating, she said. I was so embarrassed by this and said, is that really so? Yes, she replied, and I want you to gird yourself, strengthen your resolve, and copulate as hard as you can. So he ends up marrying this woman, and he's not allowed to leave the house for a full year. During that time, he does nothing but eat, drink, and copulate. And after the year passes, he escapes. He goes back to the daughter of Delilah, and she is going to kill him for having married another woman and for breaking his cousin's heart. But out of respect for Aziza, she only castrates him, and that is the source of Aziza's sorrows. And that is the story of Aziz and Aziza.
Yeah. So he's kind of an idiot all the way through. Like you said, not really our number one protagonist in this thing, right?
Not just an idiot. He is dumb, but he's also so cold. He has no concern for his poor cousin. And it's not that he doesn't know that she's in love with him, right? Like he very, very selfishly uses her because she has something that's of benefit to him. And I mean, the same is true of the daughter of Delilah. The same is true of this woman he marries. Does she even have a name?
I don't remember if she does or not, but I do think that he I think he is ignorant of his cousin's love.
So maybe he's just stupid.
I couldn't figure it out, honestly. I think you could read it maybe either way, but it seemed like he's supposed to be, like, the reason he needs her to be interpreting all these signs for him all the way through is, like, he just has no idea about, like, he's dumb. He's like naively dumb, you know, like he doesn't understand the ways of the world, the ways of women, like doesn't know what a rooster does, you know, like,
right.
Just like he just seems like really, really, yeah, stupid. But like, it's not an excuse for his coldness, you know, like it seems like the lesson is he should know better all the way through, but
right.
He doesn't for whatever reason. He should, but he doesn't.
He's childish, right? So he's after these very adult pleasures of getting drunk and having sex. And yet he has a child's conception of what that should be like, right? He's it's like a guy who eats nothing but Captain Crunch.
Right.
But what strikes me, what I like about this, is it suggests this secret world run by women.
Yeah.
Right? He's, I believe, the only man in the story. There's his mother, there's Aziza, there's the daughter of Delilah, there's the old woman, and there's the old woman's daughter. And every step of the way, they are in charge of his life. And he has just nothing to do with it, basically. He floats from woman to woman, and they kind of run things for him. And there's this secret language that they speak that he's not capable of learning, that all he can do is memorize. They're the ones writing the poetry. They're the ones setting the rules for everything. And he just goes along with it. He doesn't even protest, other than not marrying his cousin when he's supposed to. He doesn't even really protest. Right.
But then, like, yeah, but that leads to, like, a literal emasculation. Right,
right.
Like,
that's right, yeah. I don't know. He's been emasculated his whole life, and then he actually becomes emasculated.
Yeah, it's a very strange story. And I think it's interestingly placed in our story, you know, because it seems like it's nested in order to show us a contrast with, you know, this next story that we're going to tell, maybe, is part of it. But, yeah, it's a weird one.
And there's the weird fairy tale-ish parallel between their names, the fact that he's Aziz and she's Aziza, so it suggests they're a match set, and yet they're imperfectly matched because he doesn't care about her. I really liked the story, and I like that the meaning of it is kind of floating just beyond your ability to comprehend the meaning of it. It seems like it's saying something beyond just the ethical implications of it. It seems like there's a metaphysical statement being made here, but that statement is never actually made, which I think is typical of a lot of these Arabian Nights stories.
Yeah. I'm not sure what that statement is, though. Do you have a guess?
No, I, like I said, we're almost in the position of Aziz, in that there's this kind of complicated language that we don't have the ability to speak, you know, and we just kind of find ourselves in the middle of people speaking it.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like a. Yeah, it's almost like a parable in that way, right? Where it's like it draws you into the story, but the place where it leaves you is not a very comfortable one, because I don't want to be in the place of Aziz, you know?
Right.
Hmm.
So you didn't like this one as much as I did, huh?
I don't know. I didn't dislike it. I found it very strange, you know. I mean he's a frustrating character. In that, like, you know, he only does the right thing, like you said, like, without really knowing why or how. And, you know, like, even when he, like, says the lines, like, at first he forgets it the first couple times, you know, and then he finally remembers to say them. The thing that I liked about it was it seems like the cousin, Aziza is the cousin, right?
Yeah.
She, even though this is like killing her, you know, she continues to love him and continues to, I mean, it's mentioned in the story a few times, like it's her kindness even beyond the grave, you know, like her giving him that last crucial clue of, loyalty is good and treachery is bad, or whatever, is the thing that saves his life even beyond the grave, you know.
Well, and she tells her aunt, his mother, not to blame him for her death, even though he is 100% responsible for her death.
Yeah,
she has this really outrageous charity toward him, whereas, I mean, you're rooting against him, I hope, as you're reading the story, you know.
Yeah, you are. Well, because, and it's like, yeah, there's a deep irony in it, because he keeps like going and gorging himself on this food and falling asleep because he believes that he's really desperately in love with this woman. And meanwhile, like his cousin, like can't sleep, can't eat, because she actually truly is desperately in love with him. You know, like, I mean, that's the idea, is that there's this like power of love that's so strong that it overcomes you, even to the point of, Yeah, like you stop caring for yourself if your love is strong enough, you know? And his cousin Aziza obviously has that, even to the point of death. Whereas meanwhile, he's like, you know, he can't even, you know, resist food for a couple hours until Delilah the shows up, you know?
Right.
It's really, there's a deep irony in it. So that there's yeah, so I wouldn't say I disliked it. I just found it I don't know. I didn't quite know what to think make of it.
But then you also have this idea that she is helpless to kill him in a certain way when he says the magic words, when he says loyalty is good, treachery is bad. All of a sudden, she's not able to do the things she wants to do to him. There's a I well
Yeah.
We'll eventually get to Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, which is in our volume, but is not actually part of the Arabian Nights. But it's kind of like saying open sesame, right?
Right, yeah, and I don't know, there is an interesting thing there, like that again, like it seems like how do you say it? It's like just beyond the surface or something, you know, like it's there's something really interesting about that, but there's also something, you know, he gets one night out a year from, you know, this lady that he marries who's ostensibly saving him from Delilah. That's hard to know if that's true or not, or if that's just another tale that he's being to told, you know.
Right.
And then the way that he spends his one night is he goes back to her, you know. Like it's very strange.
Well, and
It's
she's
very
the
strange.
daughter of Delilah, right? So the Samson parallel has got to be intentional. And Samson's the same
Oh
way.
yeah, for sure.
Like Samson knows Delilah
Yeah.
is trying to get the secret of his hair or secret of his power so she can get rid of his power. And yet he keeps going back to her because Samson,
Yeah.
also kind of a dullard.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, there's a real parallel there with Samson. It's true.
I really liked this story. It's been one of my favorites so far.
It
So,
wasn't bad. It was not bad. I wasn't as enthusiastic about it,
let's move on
I
then to the thrilling conclusion of Taj al-Muluk Quran and Princess Dunya. Now, this is the
Yeah,
conclusion to
who
the
we've
story
barely met at this point.
is very, very funny to me. So,
Yeah, I liked this one. I was more enthusiastic about this one.
Taj al-Muluk has fallen in love with Princess Dunya on the strength of her embroidery, as many men do. And
Yeah,
so
that checks out.
his father, King Suleiman, sends an embassy to the Camphor Islands to request marriage between her and his son. But her father refuses because Princess Dunya, as it turns out, hates men. And she has sworn that she's never going to get married. And she says that if a man so much as tries to marry her, she's going to tear him to pieces. And we're eventually going to find out the reason why she has sworn never to get married. And just to preview it, it's stupid as all hell. So we'll get to that. Well, Taj al-Muluk is not a man to give up so easily. You know, a woman who makes embroidery this beautiful has got to be so beautiful that you have to marry her. And so he and Aziz and the royal vizier disguise themselves and they travel to Dunya's kingdom, the Camphor Islands, where they become successful merchants. And it turns out that Dunya's elderly nurse regularly comes to the marketplace. And Taj al-Muluk ends up forming this relationship with her because he keeps giving her gifts. And eventually she agrees to take his letters to the princess. So he writes letter after letter declaring his love. They get increasingly elaborate. And she writes letter after letter refusing to marry him. And so finally the old woman explains. I'm skipping over some stuff, by the way. There's a weird scene with a bathhouse and an elderly homosexual man who's trying to seduce Taj al-Muluk and Aziz. And we could talk about that if you want to, Josh. But eventually, the old woman does explain why Princess Dunya refuses to get married. It turns out she had once had a dream where a male pigeon abandoned his mate in a fowler's net. And so, like any sane person, Princess Dunya concluded that this dream obviously meant she could never trust any man. So Taj al-Muluk is not dismayed by this. He comes up with a plan, which is that there's a park with a pavilion where Princess Dunya walks every day, and he hires a painter to paint this pavilion with a similar scene. So he's got the female pigeon caught in the net, But it turns out in the painting that the male pigeon has not actually abandoned her. Instead, he's been captured by a hawk while returning to rescue her. And this utterly ridiculous plan works. Princess Dunia is convinced she has misinterpreted the dream, and she decides she's able to trust men after all. And finally, the two of them meet in person, and she falls in love with Taj al-Muluk because he's so handsome and charming. And her nurse sneaks him into the palace every day dressed as a woman. And the two of them live in disguise for a full month before eventually a palace eunuch finds them and tells the king, who is preparing to execute Taj al-Muluk. And then there's a pretty big anticlimax, which is Taj al-Muluk, his father finds out about all of this. And the vizier of the kingdom goes to the Camphor Islands with an army. And once Dunia's father realizes who Taj is, he lets them get married. And they live happily, not ever after, but until death takes them, which is the kind of standard formula here in the Arabian Nights. And that's the story of Taj al-Muluk and Princess Dunia.
See, I disagree with you a little bit that it's anticlimactic. Like, the timing was really, because he's missing for this month. Like, he goes into the castle. And, the vizier and our friend Aziz from the Nest story, they don't know what happened to him. And they assume that he's probably been killed because this is a dangerous thing. So they go back to their kingdom and prepare to attack this kingdom unless they can produce, the prince. And they just happen to show up on the day when he's like about to be executed. It was I thought it was very
that's true. I guess dramatic. It's not as climactic as I thought it was.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I agree that it's very stupid, but I love his idea. Like, he hears the dream and he figures out this way to like reinterpret it and paints this picture for her. You know, he's fallen. I mean, it'd be better, I guess, if he painted it because he fell in love with her artsmanship and
right, maybe she would right. fall and, in love with and his, she but. Doesn't fall in love with him because his art is so beautiful, which would also be the better parallel. Instead, you know, it's the old story that she sees him and he's so handsome.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it could be better, but I think that plan, it's so fun. Like, it's so funny. Like, when he's like, oh, break me into, because he's not even supposed to, I think the idea is, you're allowed to go into the garden unless the princess is going to be there. And then they kind of shoo everybody out. Right.
Right.
And so he kind of goes into the garden where he knows that she frequents and hires this painter to paint these scenes. It's meant to be, you know?
And then also there's a parallel to the story of Aziz and Aziza in the sense that you have this semiotic language, right? That it's not that he sits down and talks to her. It's not that she falls in love with him and that's why she goes back on her promise. It's that he manages to convince her by the same, not exactly the same, but by a parallel process by which she became convinced that men were no good. And also, it kind of rang true to me because surely you've had the experience where your wife has been a little bit mad at you because of something you did in a dream. Not even your dream, in her dream.
Yeah. Haven't we all? Haven't we all?
So, I mean, maybe not as unrealistic as I thought.
Yeah. I mean, if you believe in dreams importance, you know, like you get the dream and, you know, you've got to interpret it some way. And
right. And if the story had said, if Princess Dunia had said, well, God is trying to tell me something through this dream, but she doesn't bring in any kind of metaphysics to it at all. It's just, I had this dream and therefore all men are bad. But you're right. I mean, this would have been a culture that put much more stock in dreams than we do.
Yeah. And then, I mean, imagine that you have a dream and then you're walking in the garden and you see a painting of your dream. Like that'd be quite a shocker, I think. That could be very convincing. It's unfortunate that it's all manipulation, but
also it's hard to blame Princess Dunia for not trusting men. The men in these stories are often not terribly trustworthy.
It's true.
And certainly, well, I don't know. The frame story in this one suggests that maybe women don't totally give up their power when they when they get married. Because, I mean, in the very next section of King Umar, you get Nujat kind of running things a little bit, at least. But this is certainly not a culture where women have a lot of power. Although more than maybe you would expect.
Yeah. And particularly in this, you know, particularly in these tales, I think.
Right. I just finished talking about how the world of Aziz and Aziza is just totally run by women.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's hard to quite grasp what exactly it was like at the time that these tales were originally being told.
Right. And of course the stories aren't trying to be realistic at all.
Yeah.
At least I assume they're not. I assume nobody would have imagined this is what life is actually like. Any more than...
Right, yeah, I mean...
Any more than you would imagine that there are wicked witches living in the forest who are going to eat children.
Yeah. Giants living up beanstalks and all that stuff, you know.
Right.
So. I liked this one. I thought this was a good story. Unrequited love or whatever. it was a good story. It was diverting, which I think is what it's supposed to be, you know? It's supposed to, like, help you get over your sorrows. So, a very happy ending. This was nice.
Well, a happy ending until death comes for them.
That's right, yeah.
The destroyer of happiness. Isn't that what it calls it?
The destroyer of delights, I think.
Yeah.
Which is a great name for death in some ways. All right. Should we get into our last story?
Yeah, and I'm going to let you summarize this one, the ending of King Umar.
All right. Well, as I said at the beginning, King Umar is actually dead. And he had a couple sons, or a son and a daughter. And what did he have? Oh, man. I'm already messed up. Sorry.
King Umar had Sharkan, and then he had a whole bunch of other daughters. But then he has the twins, Dawa Maluk.
He has the twins. Dawa yes, Makan. Yes, Dawa.
Yeah, Dawa yes. Makan. And...
Yeah, Dawa Makan. So Dawa Makan is our main character here at the beginning, because Sharkan is dead and King Umar is dead. And they are, if you remember from last week, or if you didn't listen last week, they are actually besieging Constantinople because of a whole series of things, including the kidnapping of one of King Umar's wives, right? Sophia?
I think Sophia is his concubine.
She was a concubine. Yeah, concubine Sophia and another lady who is going to come up here in a minute. Anyway, they're both have been taken, and so there's this whole war going on, war of attrition. It's been 4 years now, basically. They've been sieging for 4 years, and they're all getting a little tired of it. So Dawa al-Makan decides, hey, we're going to go back, and we'll attack them again later. I haven't seen my son. I haven't seen my niece. Sharkan has a daughter, and they're betrothed to be married, you know, and we haven't seen them. And so they get up, and they head back. And he spends some time planning this holy war when they're going to go back. But then just as he's got his plans all together, he gets the vizier, Dandan, and he tells him, you know, I'm going to make my son king, and that way I can enjoy him being king. And Dandan says this is a bad idea, because kings who do this, they die soon afterwards, but he does it anyway. And he does die afterwards. And there's a tragic line here where it says there was passing of time. It was as though he never had been. So he's kind of forgotten.
Certainly the story forgets him.
The story forgets him for a long time. He's going to come back at the very end, but for a long time, he's forgotten. So Kanamakana, though, does not, even though he made this plan that Kanamakana would become king and would marry his cousin, which is interesting that we've got another cousin love story here. And how do you pronounce her name? Michael? Kwidia Fakana, maybe?
I think it's Kwidia Fakana.
Kadia. Okay. So we've got Kana Makana and Kadia Fakana, and they are betrothed. This whole plan is in place, But the Chamberlain ignores all of it and becomes king himself. So they are growing up, but then at the time of puberty, they're separated. And there's a one particular party where Kanamakana comes and he sees her and he recites some poetry at her. And this is a very shameful act, I guess. She gets angry. She threatens to disgrace him in front of the Chamberlain, who's now the king. And she goes and complains to her mother and he goes off brokenhearted. So there's again this like division of love. And his mother tells him, look, you're like, you are living in the grace of the Chamberlain right now. Like, he could have basically had you killed, had me thrown out. It's only because his mother had gone and like begged for mercy from his aunt Nuzhat al-Zaman, who is the wife, or I guess now she's the queen of the Chamberlain. That's the only reason that they're still allowed even to live in the palace. So she basically is warning him off and saying, like, you know, back off. Well, of course, the gossip gets out that Kanamakana is in love with Kadia. And when the king, who is now called Al-Malik Sasan, hears this gossip, he forbids Kanamakana from seeing her anymore. And when he gets the news, he's so upset, he says he's going to, you know, go basically live among the beggars. And so he's doing that. He's living among the beggars. And but his mother is going back and forth between him and the palace each day, bringing him food. And one day she runs into his cousin Kadia, and she says, oh, actually, I am in love with him. I just, you know, it was improper the way he was doing it. And, you know, tell him to have endurance because fortunes can change. So when he hears this, he decides, okay, I can make my way in the world and maybe come back better. So he leaves Baghdad. He leaves with nothing. He's barefoot. He's in short sleeves. He's got a 7-year-old felt cap and a 3-day-old loaf of dry bread. And he takes off and leaves. And so he goes missing, and his mother is very upset, and she begins wailing. And just basically causing a ruckus that her son is missing. And this is a problem for King Sasan, because all of a sudden, now that he's missing, people are starting to feel sorry for him and be like, hey, he's the son of the old king. And like, why is he, you know, being treated this way? Why is he, you know, being left out in the fields? And so this is a problem for King Sasan that's going to grow as our story continues. Anyway, he's wandering. Kanamakana is wandering out in the fields and or the desert, not the fields, the desert. And one night, it's the pitch dark of night, but he hears poetry being recited. Of course he does. This is, you know, the Arabian Nights. What else would you hear? And so they can't find each other in the night because it's so dark. But they recite poetry to each other all night long. And in the morning, he sees that it's this Bedouin. And he asks this Bedouin who it is. And he says he is Sabaim Rama. And he has a tragic tale that is, you know, it's in parallel with all these other stories where he is in love with his cousin. And his uncle has demanded this enormous dowry, and he can't provide it. So he's off in search of his fortune. And so Kanamakana thinks, oh, we should, you know, team up, and we can both seek our fortunes together. But Saba is an angry and arrogant person. And instead of agreeing to this, he wants to basically take Kana as a ransom. He finds out Kana is the son of a king, and he thinks, well, you're my path to riches. I will just kidnap you and get the ransom, and then I'll have the money that I need to marry my cousin. So Kana says, this is dishonorable unless you fight me first. So they fight, and of course Kana beats him. Saba asks for mercy, and Kana gives it to him and lets him go. So then, as soon as he lets him go, he prays this amazing prayer. He says, my God, who sends down the rain and feeds the worms among the rocks, I ask you through your power and gentle mercy to provide me with a livelihood. And just as soon as he prays this, this guy comes riding up on the most beautiful and amazing and otherworldly horse that Kanamakana has ever seen. It is a glorious, glorious horse. And we have seen this horse before in the story, but it was a long time ago during the war in Constantinople, and it belonged to the Christians in Constantinople. But Kamen Makana doesn't know that. I'm just throwing it in there for us because you may not remember that you've seen this horse before, especially even if you're reading it, you may not remember that. So anyway, the man riding the horse is a man named Gasan, and he is fatally wounded. And so he tells his tale of he has been trying to steal this horse. It was in the hands of the evil witch Dat al-Dawai, who has been, the main antagonist in the story, the one who has killed the king and killed Shakar. And she was taking this horse to Baghdad to give it to King Sasan, probably for he says to sue for peace, but we could guess that, this is probably another one of her schemes. So anyway, he's been trying to take it, but before he could steal it, another band of robbers led by this guy Karadash showed up. Karadash showed up and stole the horses, but of course he let Dat al-Dawai go because she's wily and she convinced him to do that. And Gasan, our fatally wounded person here who's telling his story, he tracked Kardash back to his camp, stole the horse from there, but in the process of stealing the horse, was fatally wounded. So he shows up with our boy, Kanamakana. Kanamakana nurses him until he can tell the story, and then he dies. So now Kanamakana has this amazing horse. Meanwhile, Vizier Dandan and half the army have cast off their allegiance to King Sasan, and they will only have Kanamakana as king. And he has taken the army all the way from India to Africa, and he's been recruiting reinforcements all along the way. And now he has this huge army, and he's preparing to attack Baghdad, swearing not to sheathe his sword until Kanamakana is king. But Kanamakana doesn't know that. But King Sasan does know that. So when King Sasan hears that this terrible thing is, this military coup is coming for him, he opens up his treasuries to try and win the loyalty and favor of those who are still with him. And he's passing out goods, and he's telling everyone that if only Kanamakana would return, he would appoint him as commander of the troops, and he wants him to come back, and he'll give him all this. So Kanamakana hears this from some traveling merchants. He's out in the desert, and some traveling merchants tell him this story. And so he returns to the king with the stallion as a gift to make peace. And so the king recognizes the horse from back when it was in Constantinople, and he remembers that Kanamakana's dad wanted it, like really coveted that horse. And so he receives the horse from Kanamakana, but then gives it back to him with robes. And he's trying to keep him as happy as possible because he's worried about this military coup. So Kanamakana goes back to his mother, asks about Kadia. She refuses to tell him anything because she says, this is all, all your troubles are because of this love. And so she's out of it. But he finds another old woman to be his mediator instead. And she's convinces Kadia to come visit him that night. But he falls asleep waiting for her. And after the stories that Michael just told, I'm like panicking. I'm like, what's happening here? But unlike in those stories, she wakes him up. He apologizes. They spend the night talking. She leaves in the morning, but word gets out. Hey, Kadia and Kama have spent the night together. And so he's ready to kill her because this is, they're very improprietary. Is that the right word? And so he's going to kill her. But her mother, Nuzhat al-Zaman, comes in, stops him from doing that, and says, just be patient. Meanwhile, now, there's so many twists and turns in the stories. Now, Kanamakana says, I'm going to go be a highwayman. I'm going to go out and I'm going to steal a bunch of stuff until I'm wealthy enough to ask for my cousin's hand in marriage. So this time he's able to stay awake. So I guess he's growing as a person and in his love. Kadia visits. He tells her, I'm off and I will return to have your hand in marriage. On his way out of the city, who should he run into but Saba, that guy that he fought in the desert. Saba is still in the same shape that he was before. He has not found his fortune yet, but now that he sees Kana on this amazing horse, he's ready to follow him. So they go out together, and they come across a giant herd. And who should belong, like, this herd belongs to Kardash. Remember him? So they fight Kardash. They end up easily winning. They cut off his head. They take all the spoils back to Baghdad. He has won the respect and admiration of all the merchants that they see on the way, because Kardash has been, troubling them for years on the roads. He distributes the spoils. Everyone loves him. This is great for everybody except for King Sasan, who is realizing, like, oh, everybody loves Kana Makana, and he's this great warrior, and he's generous, and, you know, it's bad. So he gets his closest cronies together, and they make a covenant that they're going to kill Kana Makana. So Kana goes out hunting. He sends an emir and soldiers to kill him, while he follows behind. But Kana once again defeats all of these soldiers. Sasan has to flee. When he gets back to Baghdad, the Baghdadians are sick of him. They take him and they throw him in a tower, basically. So Kana Makana hears about this. He goes to see King Sasan, and he's still trying to make peace. And King Sasan denies that he ever tried to kill him. And so he forgives him. They ride off together into the desert. They reconcile. He says, is there anything about me you don't like? And King Sasan says, no, of course not. But when they get back to the city, everyone's singing the praises of Kana Makana and saying that he should be king. And Sasan talks to his wife, Nujat, and she says, just let him marry Qadiya. And he's so angry about this that he's threatening to kill Nujat. And so then she says, oh, no, I'm just kidding. That was a joke. We'll figure out how to kill him together. And she says, I'll have Bakun do it. Bakun is this lady who helped raise Kana Makana. And so she has his trust. But Qadiya overhears this, goes to Kana Makana's mother to warn him. So Bakun is telling stories to Kana Makana, including a very dirty story that we're probably going to talk about in a minute. And because she has this dagger hidden, she's telling him stories to get him to fall asleep, and then she's going to kill him with the dagger. Well, he's just falling asleep when his mother bursts in and saves him. Bakun quickly leaves, but his mother says, hey, she was going to kill you. There's this plot against you. And he says, okay, we should go. And so they flee the city, and they go and they meet up with Dandan, who's got the army. And meanwhile, something happens. We're not told what, but Nujat and Qadiya and several officers also flee King Sasan. He's losing everybody now. And so they're all out in the desert together, with their huge army, and they're planning what they should do, when all of a sudden King Rumzan, the king of Rum, shows up and captures them all. So King Rumzan grabs them all before, grabs all our principal players are all before him. And he says he has this dream, and he has heard that only Dandan can interpret the dream. And in the dream, he was being tormented in a pit, and he's trying to get out of this pit, and he sees beside him a golden girdle. And he picks it up, and when he does that, it becomes two girdles. But then when he ties them around his waist, they again become a single girdle. And Dandan says that this means that he has some relation of flesh and blood who is the best in the family. And King Rumzan isn't totally satisfied with his answer, so he decides he's going to kill them all, thinking this will dishearten all the troops, and he'll have an easy victory. He'll be able to conquer this whole area. But just as he's ready to kill Kama, in runs the nurse, and she says, you cannot do this. This is your sister and your niece and your nephew. And King Rumzan does not see how is this possible. And I will admit that I also did not see how this was possible. I had completely forgotten part of our story, but she reveals how this is all possible. She says, my name is Mariana. I am the maid of Abriza. Abriza was the woman from our story,
like the woman warrior whom Shar Khan fell so deeply in love with.
Yes, the woman warrior that Shar Khan fell in love with. But when he brought her back to visit dad also fell in love with her, and he had her, and they had a child together, and that's King Rumzan. But I totally forgotten that. So anyway, they were escaping together. There was a black slave that they had hired. And he betrayed them. He killed her just as she was giving birth, but King Rumzan was still born. And when he was born, this Mariana gave him the stone. You might remember, you might not. There were these three stones that seemed really important at the beginning of the story, and they disappeared. I didn't think they were ever coming back, but they did. So he received the stone, and King Umar also, is that his name? Umar. Yeah, he also gave one of those stones to Nujat and also to Dal al-Makan. And so Nujat has hers.
This is how Sharkhan realized that Nujat was his sister. You'll recall after he impregnated her.
Yes, yeah, because of these stones. So the stones reveal the family. So Nujat still has her stone. Dal al-Makan had given his stone to Khan-i-Makan, and so he has his stone, and so all three of them have the stones. The stone reunited. It's like, you know, the stones of power. The dream's meaning is revealed. The army begins to celebrate. Everybody wonders what this could mean. And there's no battle because now King Rumzan is Khan-i-Makan's uncle, and you know, there's rejoicing throughout the land, and this is amazing. And then they decide they're going to rule as equals, and they'll each take one day turns. And you would think that was the end of the story, but there's a little bit more. There's just a little bit more. This happiness lasts for some time until one day a merchant arrives and complains that these raiders have stolen all of his goods. So they ride out together to attack get the raiders and get the goods back. And in the process, they find out that this is the very merchant who had bought Nujat all those years ago and had sold her to Sharkhan, thus, you know, rescuing her from slavery because he saw that she was of royal blood, if you remember that part of the story. So anyway, this is the same merchant. And so Nujat awards him greatly, says God does not allow good deeds to be wasted. Then they bring in the three leaders of the raiders, and they're each allowed to tell their tale. And lo and behold, the first raider is the Bedouin merchant who had kidnapped Nujat and was, you know, treating her horribly. And so when she realizes this is the same guy, the light becomes dark in her eyes and she's ready to kill him. He asks if he can tell one more tale to try and save his life. The kings grant him this, but then this tale is just as wicked as his other tale about kidnapping Nujat. And so Nujat cuts his head off. And then the second thief gets to go, but this thief turns out to be the slave that I was just talking about a second ago, who was supposed to be helping Abriza escape and betrayed her and killed her. And so then King Rumzan gets vengeance for his mother and beheads him. And then the third man, would you believe it, is the camel driver who was supposed to carry Dal al-Makan to the hospital in Damascus. This was like when he was really sick and about to die.
These guys must be 80 years old by this point.
The time in this story is crazy. But anyway,
also you haven't mentioned this. Everything you've said since the dirty joke has been three nights of the story. This is amazing. Like, you're telling it at about the speed Scheherazade must have told it.
He actually dumped him outside the furnace. So Khan-i-Makan gets vengeance for his father by beheading him. And so now there's one loose end left. It's that old wily witch, Dawat al-Dawai. And she is, fascinatingly enough, King Rumzan's great-grandmother. So he writes her a letter, and he says, hey, guess what? I conquered all the lands that you've been trying to conquer for your entire life. And so bring Queen Sophia, who's Nujat's mom, and come on, we'll have a party. But when she arrives, they disguise themselves and capture her, and they crucify her on the gates of Baghdad. And all her companions convert to Islam. And so ends the story of King Umar and his progeny.
Oh man. What a complex ending that. But you have to, I mean, one thing we wondered last month is whether they were going to be able to tie up all the loose ends, and they tied up every single loose end.
They did. Not entirely satisfactorily, satisfactorily in the sense of justice is done. But like, I feel like the pacing on this story was very weird.
Yeah.
Like they would spend a long time on stuff that didn't seem important at all. And then like, oh, here's the three jewels, and they all, you know, like, it was just like ding ding ding. And so
it's like they had it's like they had a deadline to finish writing the story.
Their show got canceled and we had to finish it all in this season.
On the other hand, I didn't want this to go on for another 50 nights, I have to say. I was ready to be done with the story of King Umar and his family.
Right. So the parts that I really liked about it is I do like stories that take place over multiple generations. I think they're really fascinating. And all the the family tree of this family is, you know, so bizarre, you know, with
right, because Qadia is Kanamakana's double first cousin.
Right.
Double first cousin by blood. So they're almost like half cousins. I don't know. There's probably not a term for it. Which is why I'm surprised Nujat wanted to allow them to get married. Surely that's some sort of kinship violation.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah. But then, I mean, even then, like, they're all like related through Sophia. They're all related back to like the emperor, you know, because Sophia was, you know, there's that whole beginning part of the story where she's like, you know, been captured by pirates or whatever, you know, and brought to Baghdad. And they didn't know she was the daughter of the emperor. And then like, yeah. And so like all the royal families are like interlinked also. And
well, yeah, you get this holy war that doesn't end with the conquest of Baghdad or the conquest of Byzantium. Instead, it ends with almost like an unwilling, unknowing marriage. It's not even really a marriage, but it ends in kinship relations instead of in violence or conquest, which is interesting. It's a happy ending, and justice is done on every corner, right? Like everybody who had something coming to them gets it, and everybody else just kind of lives happily. And even the Christians convert to Islam, which of course in the world of the story is about as happy an ending as you can get.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing how it all tied up. And I didn't even mention the furnace man, you know, like,
yeah, he gets his reward as well. He has made the, I think that was actually in the part of the story that I should have covered right at the very beginning. I don't remember, but anyway, he's made the Sultan of Damascus. He gets Sharkhan's old position.
Yeah.
So goodness is rewarded, which is a claim that's made several times over the course of the King Umar novel. I won't even call it a story. It's 300 pages long. That God rewards good deeds. Good deeds are more than rewarded by God. And that definitely happens for some of the characters. I mean, some of the characters are killed in an ignominious way. But if you're still alive at the end of the novel, you're going to be rewarded for your good works. Whereas like Princess Abreeza, who is... I still think probably the most appealing character in the entire novel. She dies this horrible death out of nowhere. That raises the stakes of the novel, I suppose. But I mean, if you're thinking of the main characters of the story not being individuals but being families, the family is rewarded at the end. Justice is done because the slave, who must be 100 years old by then, who cuts off her head is himself executed.
Right. Yeah. It would be interesting to like try and map out the actual dates of some of these things. I mean, not like literally in our timeline, but just like how long did the story take? But I did not do the work to do that.
No, me neither. It was all I could do to keep track of what was happening by the end of the story because it's moving so fast.
Yeah. And it's kind of fun. I mean, it was really like King Rumzan showing up. I was like, oh yeah, like she had another kid. And at the time I even made a note. I was like, what's going to happen with this kid? You know,
that's because
it seems important, you know, that she like has, I don't know exactly how medically it worked that she got beheaded and then delivered a baby, but somehow it happened. But then I just forgot about him. Like, he was just, you know, there's so many other characters and so many other things happening. So when he shows up, I was like, oh yeah.
Well, we spent so long with Grimms where characters will be introduced and then they'll die and the story will just take a total 90-degree turn and never come back to that I really was not expecting everything to get wrapped up as neatly as it did get wrapped up, even if the way it happened was not incredibly artistically satisfying, just because it does happen so fast.
Yeah. I'd really given up on the jewels. Like, I thought they are now, there's no way they're coming back. Cause at the beginning I was really trying to track like who has the jewels and where are they? Because the jewels also, like, they're supposed to have like these magical powers, you know, like they always protect the person who's wearing them and stuff, which I guess came out to be true because they all survived to the end of the story. But like, I'd really given, like, when they came back at the very end, I was like, I can't believe they brought the jewels back. I thought they were gone for sure.
Yeah, that's right. And they're used the way they're used throughout the story as agents of identification.
Yeah. Although even like, so the way I told it, I brought out that agent of identification a little more, but they really, like, they didn't need them to do the identifying. It was kind of like confirmation of the identity. Whereas I feel like in a modern story, it would be more like the actual identification. Like they wouldn't tell the stories of who each other were until they saw the jewels.
Which is what happens earlier with Shar Khan and Nuzhat.
Right. But in this story, but in the end story, they kind of all tell their stories to each, like Mariana comes out and, like, you know, he doesn't quite believe them. And so he has them all separated and, like, kind of interrogates them one by one, and they all have the same story. And then the jewels come out and it, like, is confirmation of everything, you know? So I thought that was interesting that they told it that way.
I wonder if there are any stories longer than this. I mean, there's not in our volume, but we only have the first third of the 1001 Nights. So I wonder if we're going to get another one that's... What it was. This was like, I think 300 pages. I don't remember how many nights.
Yeah, I don't remember either, but it's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, let's see. It ended on night 145, and I think it's... started on 45, so it was basically 100 nights.
Right, it was twice as long as everything we had read up to this point.
Yeah.
Well, I knew we were in trouble when we looked at it, and it was like, oh, there's not a break in the story. There's not a nested story for more than 100 pages, because we tried to do 100 pages a month. It's like, oh my gosh! And then to finish it, we had to do more than 100 as well.
Right. Yeah, the nested stories, because there's such a, like, big part of the in the beginning of the novel, the collection. And then in this story, for them not to have a nested story for so long was very unusual.
Yeah, it is much closer to a novel. I won't say a modern novel, but it's much closer to a novel than to a fairy tale. But in the next section, we get this rapid-fire series of animal fables, so... The book is big enough and capacious enough that it contains lots and lots and lots of types of things.
Yeah, it contains multitudes.
I do want to talk very briefly about the dirty joke, the story of the hashish addict, and we won't talk about the dirty joke part of it, but I was interested in this story because what happens is you get a poor man who takes a bunch of hash, marijuana, and he falls asleep in a bathhouse and dreams he's wealthy. And he's happy during it. And I found it very interesting because at the same time I was reading that story, I was reading Blaise Pascal's Pensée, and there's a section where he says that a beggar, an artisan, I think he says, who dreamed for 12 hours a night that he was a king would be functionally identical to a king who dreamed for 12 nights he was an artisan. So there's the sense that the dream and the reality are not super super different. It's just that the reality lasts longer than the dream. And I felt like the story of the hash addict was pushing at that. I won't repeat the punchline because it is truly dirty, but it is one of the things I've laughed the hardest at in the 1001 Nights. It's a very funny joke, but I was just just interested briefly in this way that the dream is indistinguishable from the reality. And he would have been happier if he hadn't been awakened to find himself this beggar.
Right.
Total social outcast. But if he could have had that dream forever, he would have died happy.
Yeah.
Living in unreality.
Yeah. It is interesting because even the like our kings in our stories, they do live extremely luxurious lives, but then they also have, you know, like, I mean, in this story in particular, like they all go through these moments of living as beggars, you know?
Yeah, there's like reversals all through the story.
Yeah. I mean, Nujah and Dal Makan definitely, like, you know, on their trip to Mecca, you know, they get sick and are reduced to poverty and nobody knows who they are. And then Kanamakana, same thing, you know. He loses the kingdom and has to, you know, leaves the city with, you know, not even shoes on his feet. So it is interesting the how much that Pascal like ties in, because they live that life also.
Yeah, every king could become a beggar and every beggar could become a king, even if it's just in his dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, we are reading substantially less, we decided, for next month. What are we reading to, Josh?
Let's see here. So next month we will be reading nights 146 to 169.
Yeah, so, which puts us right on the threshold of another 140 page frame story. I think we probably won't even talk about every story next month because there's so many of them. It's much more like Grimm's, where the stories are a couple pages a piece and it moves from one to one to one. So it'll be good to have a little bit of a break after reading such a long, complicated story to have some short, simple ones.
Yeah, I agree. I think the long, complicated ones are a little difficult to discuss too. Like I think I said last month, like we've never really tackled something like this, you know, like, I mean, we discuss movies, but even movies are digestible in, you know, a couple hours. Whereas these stories, they're, you know, it takes a long time to read through 300 pages, you know?
Right. And I was telling you last night that when we finish Arabian Nights, I look forward to doing something less complex. Because this really does take a lot of brain power to piece together what exactly is happening and to find the connections between the frame stories and the nested stories.
Yeah, that's the part where I feel like it's still similar to Aziz, I guess. Like, it's a little beyond me. Like, I'm not quite sure always why, you know, why this frame story or why this nest story here, you know? Like, what's it supposed to be doing? There's a few moments where you start thinking, oh, maybe there's a little bit of connection here with cousins and lovers and stuff, but it's still like just beyond my grasp. I'm like, I think not quite grabbing it all. There must be something else going on.
Oh, speaking of frame stories, I meant to bring this up. At the very end of night 145, where we left off, we get a continuation of the original frame story with Scheherazade and King Shahryar. It says, King Shahryar now told Scheherazade, I want you to tell me a story about birds. This is the first time I think he's made a request. And her sister.
Yeah, this is the first time we've heard from him since the whole thing started. We haven't heard from him at all. So this is the first time that he's popped in.
And her sister says to her, in all this time, it is only tonight that I have seen the king looking happy. And I hope that your affair with him will turn out well. So the king really enjoyed the ending of the King Umar story. And then It says the king fell asleep. Usually morning dawns, and that's what breaks off the story. But here she completes a story, doesn't start a new one that night, and he requests a new one. So the dynamic between the king and Scheherazade is changing slightly. You see her getting the upper hand on him a little bit.
Right. Well, we're 5 months in, basically, right? 145 nights is close to 5 months. So she's been telling these stories for a while.
There's so many left to go. Again, our volume is like 900 something pages, and it is the first of three. And I hope we will eventually come back and do the other two. But I do need a break from them.
Yeah, I understand. I think I was the one who suggested this, but I've regretted it many times.
I mean, the thing is, there's so many of them are so great that it's not a comment on the quality of the stories. It is a comment on the difficulty of the stories. Both in themselves, they're so complex. The culture they're coming from is relatively foreign to us compared to late medieval Europe. Like the Grimm's, and there's this idea that there's never a story that completes; they're just all bound together, and that makes it much harder to figure out exactly what's going on. Although I'll say, by the 800th page of Grimm's Fairy Tales, I was ready for something else too.
Yeah, for sure. Even though some of our favorites were at the very end, I think, you know, King Thrushbeard was like one of the last ones we did, but. Yeah, it wears on you. You kind of hit a point where you're like, okay, I'm in this world now and I get it. And then you hit another point where you're like, okay, I'm ready to wake up now.
Right.
So, but yeah, even though there's moments where I regret it, I'm also thankful that we're doing it. I mean, I think it's good too. It's a good experience.
This is not a book I ever would have finished on my own, I'm sure. I'm sure I would have gotten 100 pages into this and said, oh, I can't do it. So I'm yeah, thankful for the opportunity to be forced to read the whole book.
yes, that you've taken the words out of my mouth. That's how I feel about it. I'm thankful for the podcast. So if you are listening, thank you. You've made Michael and I have the willpower to read this book.
And we looked at the schedule going forward, and it looks like November will be our last month of doing at least this first third of Arabian Nights. So,
just in time for another Disney movie.
Is that true? What's the next one coming out?
I feel like they tend to come out in November, right?
Oh yeah, but like we won't actually talk about it for a few months because we don't normally go to.
Yeah, we got to wait for it to get to. We got to wait for Disney Plus to get them.
So. Get them to open the vault.
Yeah. That's right. All right. Well, Michael, this has been fun.
As always.
And, as always. Let's see. Our press liaison is Christian Filipic, and we're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. And you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. Check out Michael's weekly podcast, A Symposium of Popular Songs Song over at Front Porch Republic. Is it song or songs?
It's songs.
Oh, I have it written wrong. I apologize.
It doesn't matter.
Symposium of Popular Songs. It matters, Michael. Let me get it right. Check out Michael's weekly podcast, The Symposium of Popular Songs, over at Front Porch Republic. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player styles to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, which we were saying was dead last month. But then immediately after we said it, out from the tomb came City of Man. They've relaunched it.
Literally the day I was editing the podcast. I think I removed the part of the show where we were saying it was dead. Just so that we wouldn't look quite so foolish by saying that when the new episode of City of Man came out. But it does seem to be just okay, City of Man.
Okay. Well, you can delete all this too then. I'm sorry. Michael and I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on. So thank you for spending the time with us. For Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Almanchofer. May you never find yourself without the chivalry of the noble.